VorpalNetwork.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's Jeff Greiner from The Tome Show here, and I'm bringing you a special episode straight from D&D Experience 2011. It's the second biggest D&D convention of the year. This is an unedited Wizards of the Coast session from the con. I've had some people being really fantastic about going to those sessions and recording them and sending them on to me, and so I get to share them with you. Just a quick look. Couple of quick reminders while you're listening to this. If you're listening within the first few months of 2000, or the first half, I'd say, of 2011, we have a contest going on. Go to thetomeshow.com and find a link to the contest page for all the details, where you can win prizes from Aaliyah Tools, Noble Knight Games, Sonic Legends, Obsidian Portal, Q Workshop, Gnome Stew, Sly Flourish, Epic Words, and more yet to be announced. So check those out. Also, I wanted to remind you that this episode, like all the latest Tome Show episodes, are brought to you by Noble Knight Games. Check them out, and if you happen to buy some stuff, make sure you tell them that the Vorpal Network sent you.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Hi, everybody!
Hi!
Most of you I've gamed with already this weekend. There's my DM. So this is what will probably be a very casual conversation, because it's a pretty small group of people, about sort of the art of dungeon mastering and expert dungeon mastering. And I'm Chris Perkins. I'm the senior producer at Wizards of the Coast for D&D. And this is Greg Bilsland, who is a producer for D&D at Wizards of the Coast as well. We basically tag team on all the projects that we work on to make sure that they get done on time and that the staff has everything they need to accomplish their goals. And we have a strong say in what goes into our products, but we also run our own games. I run a game every Wednesday and Monday evening. It's the same campaign for two different groups of eight players, some of whom are extremely skilled and versatile when it comes to rules and class options and knowledge of such things. And some of the players I have who are not actually members of our department are rather noobs in a lot of ways and don't have a great deal of familiarity with the content of the game. They just enjoy the people that they play with.
I've run three 4th edition campaigns over the last several years. I'm currently running a Dark Sun game. It has three noobs, as put it, people who have never played Dungeons & Dragons before. And three very experienced people from Wizards. I like to kind of have a variety of players, get a full level of skills and experience to bring a variety to the game.
So I think part of what will make this a useful session for all of us is that periodically, as questions come up, you guys should feel free to answer them from your own experience as a DM so that we can sort of share our communal knowledge of DM secrets.
As Chris mentioned, it's going to be very conversational. Yeah. We'll probably actually ask some questions of you, get some different answers, and then provide our own insights into the questions that we ask.
Right. For instance, how many of you out there are actually DMing currently? Okay. How many of you are not currently DMing but are giving serious thought to doing so? One. Okay. So, for those of you who are DMing currently, what is your biggest challenge as far as being a DM with the players that you have to DM for?
Yeah. Memory.
Remembering
anything. There is just so much.
Yeah.
And obviously, nobody can remember every single feat, every single power, and all that. And
right.
I don't care about that. You got a power I don't know, that's fine, I trust you, go ahead. but just the adventure itself, if even if I've written it, remembering, oh, I forgot to mention, that's key, and now that I mention it out of context,
right.
I'm emphasizing it, and I'm giving everything away.
Yes.
So memory for me is a big thing.
Okay. With that, that's a good one. I suffer from the same thing. I have a lot of stuff in my head.
And also, I'm a great DM, too.
Yes, 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 you are. Actually, the decision that you made, I think, to turn a lot of the onus of knowledge upon the players and say, there are certain things I am not going to bother remembering, but I'm going to trust that you remember, is one of the first great steps to success as a DM, because it lets you focus on the things that are important to your job, which is keeping the story moving, keeping the characters that they interact with interesting, and sort of adapting according to the decisions that they make. I, as far as remembering all the adventure-related stuff, before I go into a game, what I do is I type up like on a piece of paper for my binder, because I keep a log of everything that I then transfer over to my wiki after the game. But for my log on a piece of paper, what I'll do is I'll just write down the name of the adventure, the date that it's being run, the list of key NPCs that I think are going to play a part, with like a one-liner next to each NPC about who they are, and then basically a bullet point list of where I think the adventure is going to go in terms of events. This is going to happen, then this might happen, then this might happen, then this might happen. And it's usually like three or four things, because at most in a session they're probably going to get through three or four different events or encounters or role-playing situations. And that usually takes up about a half a page, and that just goes into my log, and it just sits there. It's a bit of a security blanket. I don't often refer to it, but it's there if I need it.
So, Chris, how do you keep track of information when what information the players have acquired? Like, if you've got a list of NPCs or things that the players are going to learn, and they come back to you several sessions later and they're like, oh yeah, who was that guy? And maybe you don't want to reveal everything to them because they might not have learned something then. How do you frame that?
Basically, in the bottom half of that sheet of paper, there's like a cutoff line halfway through the page, and everything that comes up during the scenario that's of importance that I need to keep track of goes on the bottom half of that sheet. So that when I'm back flipping through the notes, all I'm looking at is the bottom half of every page of stuff that's come up. And if it's a character name, like maybe they talked to this guy in town who I hadn't expected to be a major character, but he turns out to be, and I had to come up with a name for him, I'll write his name down, what he does, and I'll underline it. And I always underline the names of NPCs so that when I'm backflipping through my notes, those things pop out right away. That's sort of, it's a low-tech way of doing it. I mean, I have an iPad, but I don't usually bring it to the game because I've got so many other things on the table. And often, the iPad will like black out halfway through an encounter, and then I have to sort of reset it. It's just not worth that trouble.
Yeah. One of the approaches I take is to incentivize my players to take notes. That does two things for me. It tells me what they have learned over the course of the adventure, and also what they think is important. For example, if a player taking notes who's typed them up spends a lot of time talking about a certain interaction with an NPC, like you were saying, takes particular detail of maybe a mosaic that they saw in the dungeon, that tells me that that's important to the players, to the group, and so that then gives me material that I can use later on. I'll often cut and paste sections from the player's notes to future adventures so that I can remember to bring that back up, even if it's just kind of weaving in a little reference or a plot hook.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. One of the things, of course, when you actually want to go back and use those notes, if the player is away, the players get no help whatsoever.
Yeah.
In my Wednesday group, Kurt Gould, who is on our logistics team in WotC, basically is the note keeper, and he loves doing it. And he is always, always there. He never misses a session, except the one time he was not there when the characters did actually need information. They didn't have access to it. But
yeah.
What are you going to do? Then in that case, you have them make intelligence checks or something to see if they remember.
Yeah. But, you had a comment back there?
Yeah.
There's the player writing down notes. But there's also, just at the beginning of each session, asking the players, you know, what they remember from the previous session. That's, you know, and what's important to them can be wildly different from what you thought was important in your mind.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that Jeremy Crawford, one of our developers, does in his game is he'll ask the players to recount the last session, and then he'll see what they tell him, and then if there's other important things that we missed, he'll sort of fill in the details. But it also helps reinforce one's memory if the players are responsible for doing the plot summary. On the other hand, it's also useful for the DM to kind of frame it sometimes and say, you know, previously in Ayamandra.
I do that all the time. In fact, I do the exact opposite of what you just recommended. I just finished writing an article for Dragon Magazine, which was all about the session recap and how that's one of the most useful tools for me as a DM to not only concisely express what I think the characters need to know for the session they're going into, but also re-communicate information that may have been lost over time. And the reason I do it and why I don't empower my players to do it is because I want to make sure that information is exactly the right information for what's coming. I've been in games where the DM will say, okay, remind us what happened last session, and the players will focus on some pretty, particularly with my groups, they tend to focus on all the wrong things. They'll talk about, they'll recount all the jokes and things that came up last session and the number of times, you know, the fighter screwed up or whatever.
Or how the bow ranger did 1,000 damage to a dragon.
Exactly. They'll pick up on certain things that won't necessarily set the tone or really sort of reflect the content of where I think things are going in the coming session. So I tend to sort of take the reins of that myself and keep it like about a minute long, and they have everything they need and go. That's just me. Any other comments about note-taking and keeping track of everything?
Well, you mentioned setting up a wiki, and I just started doing that, and we really like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I play with a lot of adults who are busy with their lives.
Do they actually read it? Do they read yours? Because they don't read mine.
Yeah.
I can put things in my wiki. I put things in my wiki about stuff that hasn't happened yet,
yeah.
And they never know about it.
It's okay. Still new to them, so it's exciting.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, we have a tough time finding time for six adults to get together for more than 2 or 3 hours
yeah.
at a time. So we often play really short games, and so I have lately been asking them to read the last few paragraphs on the wiki to remember what happened, so we don't have to spend 10 minutes or 15 minutes recapping what we just did 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So that's helped us.
Do you have your own wiki, or do you use Obsidian Portal?
Obsidian Portal,
I was using Obsidian Portal mostly as just an adventure log, although it definitely was something where occasionally I'd go in and sort of embed more important information, the ability to kind of separate the secret information from the non-secret information can be really helpful. Now, we had asked originally what are some of the challenges you face as a DM. If there's any other suggestions or comments out there.
The one thing is that invariable improvisation you have to do with the DM, because you expect them to go this way and they, for whatever reason, go left. And you're like, why did they go left? I may give them no indication to go left, but they did.
That's
you know?
Why.
And you're like, okay, I got to come up with something on the fly. You know?
Yeah, the trick is to make it seem like you had it planned, right?
Yeah.
So they don't get the sense that you're unprepared or ill-equipped to deal with them. Because then it's like, you know, it's like you're just their prey.
Matt, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, improvisational skills are extremely valuable. I know he's one of the players in my Darkson campaign, and I really allow them to kind of go wherever they want to go and experience what they want to experience. Obviously, through my narrative, I can drop hints on where important places and things are, but these guys, they never cease to surprise me on what they want to do or where they want to go. And you're about on your sixth character now, right?
Which makes the game worth playing and makes the game worth DMing.
Yes.
But it also makes it harder to DM when, you know, you've got 10 pages of text and the players aren't doing any of that.
If you're running a prepackaged adventure, that can be particularly hard to have to sort of put that aside and say, okay, we're going to wrestle with this other thing you guys want to do, and somehow over the course of this, I'm going to think of a way that's going to gradually nudge you over back toward what was over here. I think that's sort of acceptable, and in many cases creates the more memorable campaigns.
One of the things I've tried to do, I run a very plot-heavy campaign where I've got these arcs sort of planned out across 10, 20 levels to try and give the appearance of a sandbox environment while still keeping them somewhat on the rails, is to have sort of story milestones, things that I want them to eventually get to points in the story where they're going to either face off with a villain or they're going to arrive at an important place. But kind of how they get there is something that I leave entirely to them.
I actually just had that problem the last game. I had set up an encounter that I thought was just going to slaughter my players. And my plan was that they'd all just get knocked out and be dragged off to the bad guy's compound. But they won the battle.
Right.
And that, so that, of course, is going to change the whole plot for me. So I'm going to have to replan that. But then that kind of leads to another problem that I've been having is making sure my encounters are tough enough. Yeah. That I often end up having the encounters be too easy. And so I'm still trying to get the hang of making sure I'm picking monsters that are they're going to give my players a real challenge.
Mm-hmm. You said the word problem. You might think of it as an opportunity. That these are not as much problems as they are just chances to not only... I mean, it's one thing for the players to discover where the campaign's going. It's another thing for the DM to discover where the campaign's going. And that can have its own interesting rewards. I don't get attached to my villains because I don't necessarily know if they're going to survive the encounter where I hope they're going to survive. But it's always nice, too, to think about, okay, what happens if things go wrong? If they all get... If they're victorious when I thought they were clearly going to be overwhelmed... Are there more monsters that could be drawn into the conflict from somewhere else? Obviously, if you're fighting on a ship, it might be hard to do. It might be a little forced to say, oh, another ship of monsters come sailing in at this point to fight you. But sometimes, too, the easy victory sits well with the players, you know? They think, okay, we're kicking ass, and then you've got to go home the next day and think, okay, what happens now? This villain guy is dead. They're not going to go over to this complex the way they should have, but maybe there's another way to lead them there. Maybe something else has happened that will draw them there.
It's interesting you were saying, talking about encounters being challenges or being too easy for the players. One of the things I've started to do is to be more attentive to the tension in the encounters, because if every encounter is hard or a struggle, then when you actually have that really hard encounter, it doesn't sit as differently from all of the easier encounters. There is something to be said. Let's say they do beat your difficult encounter, and they're going to feel very triumphant in that moment, and that's when you crush them. But trying to control the pacing is definitely a little bit of an art, and trying to see the sort of valleys and peaks in the way that the encounters flow is something that just takes time.
Yeah, and the good news is that nothing is ever wasted. Even if they never went there, you could always find a way to incorporate the material later too, which is another good skill for a DM. Yes, sir.
Going back to the question of having the players go off and do things that you didn't plan.
Yeah.
Do you or anybody else here have ideas about preparing to be unprepared? I mean, preparing to be spontaneous. I mean, spontaneity and being able, some people have that gift, but other people need tools that they can draw on quickly to move forward.
So one of the approaches I take to it is I sort of have a number of story tropes, for lack of a better term, that I'll have prepared at any one time to throw into a campaign or an adventure if they go off in the direction I don't prepare. I have sort of almost a backlog of NPCs or interactions that I can draw upon that I maybe even use several times during an adventure or campaign, or several weeks ago in one of the campaigns I'm a player in. My group might have run across a group of thugs in an alleyway who turned out to be part of a thieves' guild, and that's something that then I can kind of have in the back of my mind and use if the players go off and in a direction I don't expect.
Yeah, I've sort of got something similar. When I set up my original campaign, and I tell a lot of people this, it's good to have sort of three big stories for your campaign, three arcs that can sort of weave in and out of the campaign depending on where the characters are. So at any given time, something can happen that sort of ties back to one of those three arcs. There might be a war going on over here. There might be maybe the king's just been assassinated, and there's a political power play happening here. And then there's this group of slavers running around capturing people and selling them to the drow over here. Any of those three ideas could cross paths. So if the characters are dealing with a big plot having to do with the slavers and decide, no, we're going to go back to town and murder this guy because we hate his guts, and you're like, okay. You've done a little bit of thinking about maybe there's something else going on over there that they could get swept up into, or maybe there's a group that you were going to introduce in some future adventure you had in mind that you can sort of spring on them a bit early, maybe give them a bit of a precursor encounter to, or the other way, maybe some bad guy from their past who they killed had an ally who catches up with them there. And so you can bring something from the past of the campaign forward. They went off in this different direction. What's something they fought before? How did that go? Did that go well for them? In that case, are there bad guys who are gunning for them? Or did it go badly for them? In which case, you know, could there be something happening there that they'll be interested in dealing with to sort of redeem themselves? There are all kinds of questions you can ask yourself that might spur ideas as to what they could fight along this path you never intended the adventure to go. And it's all based on things that have happened to them before or things that you've been thinking might happen to them down the road.
And that kind of touches on something that I think is a good way to approach those off-the-rail encounters, which is to think about the consequences of what the players are doing. Sometimes it doesn't require too much improvisation, because if the players decide to go kill somebody, that's going to have consequences, and you can kind of just roll with it.
Well, you might not have a stat block for that guy.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you haven't even designed one, but there might be, like, if I have to come up with stats for creatures on the fly, if I'm not just putting together just a random assortment of monsters, one of the very useful things I keep around are flavorless stats. Like, for instance, the way 4th edition is built in particular, and I'm really sort of thinking in a 4th edition mindset right now, but it could theoretically apply to other editions as well. I know mathematically what a level 10 brute does in way of damage. I can use the numbers on my DM screen. The new DM screen has damage expressions there for creatures at different levels. Or I just know how much damage it's going to do. I know how many hit points a 10th level brute has. So I can come up with stat blocks on the fly, or I can take a stat block for any 10th level brute in the monster manual, strip out the power flavor mentally, and come up with an instant stat block for pretty much any level creature I need. So in the case of, let's say they just decide to murder this guy, whoever he is, I can take an existing stat block for a monster, not tell them I'm doing it, maybe add some power or flavor or something to distinguish that one, you know, give him his one trick. Like if I imagine he's a slippery guy who's going to try to get away from him, he'll be a skirmisher type. Maybe when he hits, he can slide or move or shift or whatever. That's his sort of trick, and maybe he has something else cool. And then I give him hit points, I give him his defenses appropriate for his level, I know how much damage he does when he hits, go. And the characters, they think, oh, he must have this entire stat block for this guy behind him.
I printed off a number of, for example, humans.
Yeah.
From various sources. I just have them keep them around at the end of the binder. And if they run into somebody, I can always just open it up and just change the
Right. Same thing if you want to fight. I use the same trick if you want to scale up monsters. The math for 4th edition is pretty simple. You know, you add X number of hit points for each level. The attack bonus goes up by 1 per level. The damage expression will change by whatever it is, 8 points per level, or depending on the creature, really. And then off you go.
The Twitterverse has some questions for you.
Let's hear one.
Sure.
I'm going to give you 3, because one of the things already answered. How do you go about prepping your game week to week?
That's a fine question, and the short answer is I do as little prep as possible. For a lot of the reasons why we've discussed, because I run a fairly open-ended campaign where the characters can literally go anywhere or do anything.
And how much long... These two questions are for Wolf Samurai. And how much long-term campaign / story planning do you do?
Haha. You should talk about what you do with your campaign world and how you have sort of plotted out the timeline.
Right. It depends on the campaign. If I'm running a game for the Acquisitions Incorporated guys, I usually try to nail that down the week before. So not a lot of prep time. If it's my, because those things tend to happen when schedules suddenly align and bang, you got to run a game. Ooh, what are they going to do? What's AFL's dead. Oh, my God. We have to figure out a way to get him back into play. But if it's my own home campaign, I am thinking about that campaign all the time. I think about that campaign when I walk the dog. I think about that campaign when I do the dishes. I am always thinking about where it's going to go and what I can do with all the characters in that campaign. I know Trevor Kidd plays a dragonborn paladin in the campaign, and he is this noble paladin of Bahamut guy whose family was once this sort of noble family that got put down, and he's trying to sort of rebuild it or get his name back. And so I'm always thinking about what are the things that I can thrust into that campaign to give Trevor Kidd, the player, fun role-playing opportunities and stuff to work with. And I do that for every character in the campaign. And that's very sort of a TV, television episode way of sort of looking at the campaign. Every character sort of gets his show or his moment of glory. And then I don't necessarily know when it's going to happen. I just think about it. And often I'll play out little ideas in my head, like Trevor's character is going to learn that his family's downfall was caused by the secret society that his father was part of. And his father betrayed the secret society, and so all these other families that were part of the society basically took him out, ruined the family, destroyed the reputation. And he's going to learn about this through something that he inherits or something that he gets, that his father was part of something very dark and mysterious but tried to get himself out of it. And he's eventually going to learn the identities of the other families that brought about the ruin, and he's eventually going to learn that two of these families that have survived all of the chaos politically are uniting to try to overthrow the government. And this is his opportunity to not only redeem his name in the eyes of the Empire, but also to stick it to two of the people who put his family to ruin. I know all these things are going to happen. I have no idea when, because they might be down in a dungeon for the next 6 months, and this is obviously not going to come into play. But those ideas are always tickling my brain.
For me, I plan a session. I only plan probably 1 or 2 weeks ahead of time. I have some of those sort of story milestones that I intend to sort of point the players toward throughout the story. One of the things I do is similar to the spotlight method for the characters, but when I, like with my most recent Darkson campaign, I worked with all the players to develop backgrounds, and then I sort of have about a page for each of them of what's going on behind the scenes for their character, the things they don't know. And then every time, usually before each session, when I'm doing preparing for that session, I'll actually go through and sort of skim through the behind the screen section I've written for each of the characters and see what parts of their background might be relevant to where they are in the story. So if they've just been imprisoned by the Templars and they're trying to get out, I can look at those backgrounds and see, oh, who else might be in prison that would be relevant to one of the characters' backstories? Or has one of the characters been in prison before, and how would they feel about that? Any of those sort of opportunities to connect what's going on in the adventure to the backstory, I think, creates a more robust experience.
So another tip that I've tried, and it actually works at higher levels more so than lower levels, because at lower levels, players are still getting a feel for the campaign and what their characters can do and sort of how invested they're going to be in their characters in terms of where the characters fit in the story. But by the time they start hitting Paragon tier, I ask them to, I'll say when they hit 11th level, send me a list of the things that you would like your character to do or accomplish for the next 10 levels, or send me a list of the things you would expect the party to do or accomplish in the next 10 levels. And from that, I'll take those lists and start thinking about ways to build adventures around those ideas. Like in one specific case I can remember, Rodney Thompson, one of my players, says, I want to get into I want to have a naval ship battle. That's one of the things he wanted. Had nothing to do with his character. He just wanted to have a naval ship battle. So I thought about that and looked for an opportunity to start building those in. He also sent me a note that he wanted his character to transform from one race into another, that he wanted to try to play with another race, but he wasn't quite sure how to do it. He, it's not something that generally the rules allow for unless you become a revenant. And so he wanted to figure out a way for that to happen. So that was something else I could think about and build an adventure around. And that was really helpful because I had those. I still have those lists to refer to, and there are so many things on the list. I know I'm not going to be able to cram them all in, but it's given me such a wealth of information as far as idea generators.
I do a very similar thing. I have a three wishes that I ask all the players to do near the beginning of the campaign that can be either story related or combat related or a magic item. So they might ask, I want to uncover a powerful relic from the Green Age, in the case of Dark Sun. One of the players wrote that they wanted to fight a land shark, you know, very mundane sort of thing. Or it might be something more general, like the player wrote, I want to lose something very dear to me and have that scar my character for his life. Those type of things give you, again, those plot resources that you can go back to each session or every few months to figure out how to weave into the larger adventure.
And all of your players want to fight land sharks. That tells you something about the campaign you should be running, too.
And looking at the third question, because I think this is a great question on two different levels, mechanical and psychological. This is from Sly Flourish, Mike Shea. And he actually has a great answer to this question himself, I know. What are the best tips you have for speeding up combat?
That was actually one of the questions I had.
Obviously,
yep.
But also psychologically, because, you know, I can imagine this game is different things to different people.
Yes.
And some people might be saying, well, why would I want to speed up combat? Where else do I have to go? Because that's what I'm playing the game for. You know, so different people have different...
That's a fine question. Any answers from the floor? Anybody got any things that you guys do to speed up combat in your games, if that's even desirable? Yes, sir.
I give my players 2 minutes.
You give them 2 minutes? You have a countdown timer essentially in your head or on a...
Yeah. If they don't, then it's basically, I take their turn for them.
Ooh.
Do you find that works?
Yeah, I guess it's... I don't know if it's the intimidation factor. What, the essentials, we've moved over to all essentials
since
then. I don't know if it's a lack of analysis paralysis from less powers, but it seems like I don't have to do that nearly as much anymore.
Mm-hmm. And part of it, they're just in a rhythm now, so they've gotten accustomed to this mandate.
They play their characters.
Right.
Yeah, I've been using essentials in my Dark Sun campaign, and I have to admit that part of the reason I chose to do that was to encourage speedier combat. I would still allow somebody to play a pre-essentials class if they really were attached to that class, but the lack of analysis paralysis certainly helps.
Yeah.
The campaign that I run for him, I speed up combat by allowing, if when I get to the next person's turn, I announce who the player beyond them is so they can start thinking about what they're going to do. When I get to them, if they're ready and they know exactly what they're going to do on their turn, and they're saying, I'm going to use this power against this enemy, move here, da-da-da, I give them like a +1 to their attack roll or something like that. I give them some kind of bonus to incentivize them being prepared so that and paying attention during combat, because I find one of the big things is combat can lag down because you go to one player and like, oh, okay, well, let me see what's going on the battlefield, whereas if they're paying attention the whole time.
Yeah.
Also, I do lower hit points, and I do significantly add damage for monsters.
Yeah, certainly a couple of quick tricks that have come up, and people blog about this from time to time, is the experiment of halving like hit points for characters and monsters. That seems to speed things up. Increasing damage from monsters certainly makes the encounters feel scarier, if nothing else, but it also can end them sooner if your characters are a little on the weak side. Yeah.
I think that depends on which side the speed needs to be, because if it's,
yes.
if it's the players that are slow, that's one solution. The other thing is that the monsters can do the things that they would normally not do, is, well, I'm going to void the marks. I'm going to go ahead and take those opportunity attacks. I'm going to go ahead and move around the battlefield.
Yeah.
I'm going to
mm-hmm.
take those charges, but I'm going to take opportunity attacks. I'm going to take ongoing damage, that kind of stuff. The creatures, the hit points, you don't have to have the hit points at that point. You're just taking damage, and it makes it more exciting for the players because what they're doing actually matters at that point.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
A couple things that you said. I think keeping a public initiative, either announcing before the player is going to go, and also then keeping the initiative list public so that all the players can know when the turns are going to come up. Along the lines of adjusting hit points and damage, I think there's a danger with just flatly adjusting it to half hit points. I think that sometimes you just want to read the tension of the encounter.
Yeah. Well, that brings up the point I was going to make, which is I think there isn't one solution to rule them all. I think you have to be aware enough as a DM how much fun is going on around the table. If everybody's having fun and the combat is going on for an hour and it's energetic and nobody seems to be suffering at all, let it go. It's everything's fine. Nobody seems to be having a bad experience. It's when someone around the table, whether it's you as the DM or one or more of the players, is frustrated by it, that really a solution needs to come into play. And these are some possible solutions. I've got a few of my own, but before I start,
I just wanted to also comment on Matt's idea of giving the players a plus one. Finding ways to reinforce the behavior through rewards is all. It has the advantage of sort of incentivizing rather than using the carrot rather than the stick, and that might work for the stick might work better for some players. The carrot might work better for others, and that's something you can figure out about your players.
Good choice. Yeah.
This is really repeating an idea. It's not my idea, but two things. Once the characters or the players become aware of monster stats, once you've gotten up to it, all of them, everybody knows that the monster has armor class 21.
Yes.
Just stick that on the board. And then everybody can see it. And then the other thing is, having characters, and you need a certain level of maturity for this, but having all of the players pre-roll where possible. I mean, some characters, some classes don't lend themselves to pre-rolling because they have to react to it. But, you know, straight up fighter can decide what he's going to do, roll it, know that it works, and then when it comes to their turn, what they do is describe in game what happened. You know, I run up, I do this, I smash him, and his teeth fly out or whatever.
Right.
And that's fun, and that encourages role playing as opposed to this kind of mechanical, okay, area attack.
Yeah, it's never fun when you're like, I run up and I smash it in the face with my hammer. One. I mean, the air.
I mean, I land on my face and hit myself with the hammer.
For role play, failure, too. I mean, failure is not failure. It's just an avenue for role play.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you miss, then smash your lock chips go flying and your axe hits the ground.
Another good tip to rolling in advance is if you're the DM and you're waiting for a character to have his turn, you say to the next player, your character is on deck. Mm-hmm. So think about what you're doing so that that sort of propels things along.
Yeah.
Over here in the corner.
Left,
Speaking about posting a public initiative or getting monster stats out, I find that you really don't want to do that until you're through the first round. People definitely should never be bored through the first round.
Right.
And if you start putting out where monsters are in initiative, where players are, sometimes you'll get people metagaming, okay, we'll delay it until after me so that I can do this. Oh, you don't have to worry about the monster, he's fine. So sometimes you need to keep some information away from the players so that you keep tension going.
Yeah.
And let me also answer this question with Mike's only answer from one of his blog posts, because I think it's better. I don't like the idea of reducing hit points or increasing damage.
Right.
Mike has powers that you can add sort of thematically to especially solos and elites, but also standards that increase, that speed things up, but without the challenge suffering. And an example is I get a close blast 2 that does X amount of damage, level plus X to hit, but then does damage to me. For an NPC, for a monster.
Yeah.
So it speeds things up, but it gives me this power that can hit all these PCs, wipe them out, but then I take a proportional amount of damage. I thought those powers really helped me speed things up and didn't hurt the challenge level.
Yeah, if it's appropriate for the monster, I think that's a great idea, and it's particularly relevant for elites and solos. The only danger is that with standard monsters, when you get to where you have too many powers on a monster, it's actually going to have the opposite effect, and it's going to slow it down on the DM side. So just trying to reconcile that and make sure if you are adding more powers to monsters that you're picking monsters where you're not going to be adding too much to the complexity level, or alternatively, like somebody said, having the monster have tactics that cause it to take more.
That was going to be one of my second tip, which was if you have a variety of monsters out on the board, they don't all have to be doing something creative. That is to say that you can have one or two monsters that are using their trademark abilities and everybody else making basic attacks, and that tends not to affect the player's perceptions of the encounter much at all. And the basic attacks are resolved much faster. There typically aren't conditions or other things applied to those, and you can just cycle through the monster's turn faster, if nothing else.
There's a tendency to want monsters to have all sorts of really cool things they can do, and that's fun to look at as a DM, but at the same time you have to recognize the reality that sometimes a monster might only be in combat for a couple rounds, or at best 4 or 5 rounds. So the average monster really doesn't need more than a basic attack, maybe one additional thematic power, and maybe a third utility power of some sort.
As somebody who largely DMs just for the RPGA, I don't have a group. I've never actually had a campaign of my own. Since I get a hit and miss of group of people, since I can't necessarily train them all to pre-roll damage, one of the other things I've done is tell me your action, tell me what your attack is going to be, you get there, and if I don't have some way as a DM of interrupting that or opportunity attacks to take, I tell them, okay, I'm going to start listening to his action, you roll your hit or miss, tell me your damage, and you have to be able to pay attention to two or three things at once that way, but it does also really help speed up play as well, especially if you're playing with strangers.
One of the things, too, to focus upon reducing combat time is to have more of an encounter focus than a combat focus. And what I mean by that is a lot of combat can get bogged down by the simple idea that, hey, we're here to clear out the room and kill every living monster in front of us. As a DM, like Chris was saying, if you're seeing that people aren't having fun, you can at any time retune the combat and say, well, let's focus on combat. Taking an even easy example of a necromancer with a group of undead. Players choose to kill the necromancer, and then just suddenly dissipate.
Right. Yep.
Refocus your encounter so that you're not just having players go into a room and wipe it clean every time. Start to modify things. You don't have to have a monster fight to 0 hit points every single encounter, every single time.
Often some of the most interesting encounters come from what happens when the monster surrenders or runs away.
Yeah. And a lot of DMs aren't comfortable doing that on the fly, but when you start to do it, it becomes almost second nature.
Yeah.
As long as you keep wired, they hear what's their purpose in the combat.
And that's what the players remember, too.
Yes, exactly.
They don't remember the straight-up fights where you killed everybody.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I would speak to is it goes back to what I was saying about controlling the tension of multiple encounters, that not every encounter needs to be one with 4 or 5 monsters, needs to be at standard level. Sometimes the players just want to feel badass, and that means that they go up to
two minions standing outside of a door.
Yeah, exactly. And in some cases, those combats don't even need to necessarily break out on the grid. I've been experimenting with just running the occasional combat narratively, kind of talking about what the players do and having it only maybe last a round or two. They maybe take a little bit of damage, but, again, they feel badass.
Yeah.
Whether in adventuring or in combat, you come up with this really intricate idea where players have to do X, Y, and Z to be able to get through it, and they get stuck on X and Y to get to the end result. How do you deal with their frustration to get them to move them forward?
If it's good frustration, I don't mind them being frustrated for a little while, because maybe the whole intention was to sort of confound them a little bit. But if it's really impeding the fun of the game, I'm trying to think of a specific example where...
Well, let's say...
If it was just a door blocking their way, there's so many... I mean, that doesn't typically come up. There's so many ways to get past that.
Let's say in an encounter you're trying... The goal is to disable a ritual, and the ritual is constantly summoning new demons into the encounter, and they have to figure out that they need to blow out the candles that are part of the ritual. They need to mess up the sigil sequence and then bloody the bad guy, and for some reason you're having trouble communicating that narratively. I think what you can go back to is don't become too attached to the idea of the way that you envisioned the encounter. The encounter can mold itself to be whatever it needs to be. If they haven't figured out that, they have to bloody the bad guy in addition to doing these two other things, then that's fine. You could have the bad guy do something to himself that either indicates that they're supposed to go attack him, or you just say, okay, well, they've done the two things, they don't need to do Y, and so they succeed.
One little trick trick or tip that I've given before is maybe the characters have something that they can help them that they don't remember that they had. Or, like, for instance, the example that comes to mind is a character has an intelligent magic item, like a sword. Character's having a big problem figuring out how to do this thing. The sword, which has been silent now for two encounters, says, "Dummy, do this. I'm tired of us standing around here. Let's move on." And they're like, "Oh, my sword is talking to me. Oh, it just gave me an idea. Okay, I know how to do this now." Sort of seeding your characters with these things, these opportunities, whether it's an NPC that they're dragging along, whether it's an item that they've got. You know, maybe it's a case where they found some item earlier in the adventure which they forgot about because it's been 4 months since you played last, that they need to stick in this wall to make it open up or whatever. You know, you can have, during the combat, the item fall out and roll on the floor. It sounds stupid, but it works. And it just gets the characters over that hump so that they can move on.
One of the things you did, Matt, in the Darkson game was using the insight skill, though I'm not sure that's what you were going to talk about. But
it's part of it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Asking players to use insight. Insight's a great skill to allow to provide information. Also rewarding characters who have unique non-combat-based abilities. I know in our game specifically, your character had some abilities and powers that empowered me as the DM to progress the story when the party was somewhat kind of having difficulty figuring out where to go. So by reinforcing that, especially with like insight, we're asking them to use any specific kind of skill. You start training your players, so to speak, to think outside the box and come up with creative solutions for progressing the game. So yeah, I think that helps a lot.
Very similar, sort of say. They're getting bogged down, and they're just sometimes players should kind of get very narrowly focused on what they're doing. They're not really thinking creatively. Sometimes I'll say, okay, non-combat, somebody tell me something non-combat that's really fun, really creative. I'll give you a +2 to the best idea.
That's a really good idea.
So then all the players just start rumbling. They sort of get out of their little box and they start rumbling around trying to think, no, maybe we do this and that. And they come up with, together, they come up with an idea, yeah, that's a good idea. And then it kind of just carries them forward, and then you can run with it and maybe be creative and push it in a certain direction. But you need to get them out of that funk.
There's no reason why they can't use skill checks that you can force. For example, the ritual, the arcanist, the player might not know, but you say, listen, roll an arcana check, and it's an easy check, but he would know what's going on. Another thing is getting the players kind of out of sight of the mindset of certain things, this is the only thing that I can do, is create cards that basically say, like an at will and an encounter that's basically do something cool and do something cooler. And they just basically, that all of a sudden, they have to think, what am I going to do? And it's not a power that I have to use that only does this. I can create what I want to do, and then the DM can adjudicate how that actually works in game.
That's a really cool idea.
Yeah.
I love it.
For a more mechanical side, in 4th edition, a lot of times, especially if people are playing in something structured like Living Forgotten Realms, or if they're new players, they tend to hold back on using some of their more powerful abilities because they're not willing to use them. And as a result, they're not killing anything, so everything is still there to hit them. And then they're afraid they don't use it until the very end, at which point they're all beat up and wondering why everything is so hard. So sometimes you have to say, well, you're using a basic attack, you have an encounter which might be stronger.
That is not my group at all. They pretty much shoot the wad right out the door. It's just, yeah.
I sometimes play with a lot of people who are advanced Dungeons and Dragons players coming from second edition.
Right, where they're rich or their resources are more spare.
Right.
Yeah.
I found a stupid trick that helps with action points. Again, you know, the players holding on to their best resources. One of my players has 2 action points. The youngest player in my group, who's 8 years old, has 2 action points, and we've made a bit of a joke about it. Oh, yeah, Josh, use one of your action points. You have 8. You know, every time we say it, his number of action points, you know, increases. Mm-hmm. It's really only 2, but, you know, by him having 2 action points, he's not afraid to use them. It kind of reminds the others, oh, yeah, I do have an action point. I have gotten them using their action points now where, you know, 2 or 3 encounters would go by, and maybe someone used their action point at the very end.
Going along the discussion of action points, I liked it. I got the wooden tokens that were done by Dragonfire. That giving those out to players really helps remind them that they've got those. Interesting house rule that one of the guys at Wizards is using, Chris Lindsay, is for action points to the person can expend the action point to either regain a daily power, can expend it to regain a healing surge, or can use it as an extra standard action. It's an interesting interpretation to the mechanic that allows you to use your action point in a way that's appropriate. So it's not just necessarily attacking, but if you really want to, you know, get one of your spells back because it's it would give you a cool opportunity to use the sleep spell, but you already used it. It's a nice way to do that. I'm actually curious about some house rules that folks have and have found successful.
I got one that I just love, and it stems from the fact I'm actually a bad DM because I'm so forgetful. But if you are in a skill challenge at home in one of my games, you can succeed completely and never roll a die. And I actually, when I do my own writing, I list out automatic success if they mention this. And it may be a little more complicated than just, mention the princess. It might be mentioned that the princess did this and that, and it's an automatic success. And that's really easy to do for social skill challenges. Mm-hmm. But even for physical skill challenges, in Black Knight of Arabelle, you go into the Brainerd's books and birds, and she says, I got a hole in my roof. And the first thing the PC does, I do an athletics check and I climb up on the wall. And I'm like, why didn't you ask for a ladder? If I told you to change that light bulb, would you start climbing the wall? Ask for a ladder.
How many PCs does it take to change a light bulb?
Depends on their athletics check.
Yeah. So I really like that it encourages role-playing. And Matt just reminded me of this, I think it was, what was it, Vic? 4 hours? 4 hour skill challenge we did? At a state dinner?
Yeah, Vic, you might have been there. Yeah, I had an entire counter set up in Balak in Dark Sun, which is a very political intrigue type setting, so to speak. And these guys had to set up a way of taking out this rather large, big bad evil guy, so to speak. But they spent 4 hours. None of my players were sitting down. They were up. And all I was doing is, it was kind of like they were building the encounter pretty much because, they had to sneak in. One had to pretend to be the butler while the other one had to. And so they had to make sure all the parts were in place so that when it was going to go down, they had most everything on their side. And what was amazing about it was when we look back, 4 hours went by. No combats ever took place. All it was setting up and allowing them to build the encounter, so to speak, so that when it actually went down, they kind of had somewhat control of it. And that's, giving your players the opportunity to do that, you'll find you will draw them right in. So
It says right in the Dungeon Master's Guide, don't feel you have to use a skill challenge to replace a role-playing opportunity. And I think that one of the misconceptions about skill challenges is that they sort of impose themselves. And they really don't have to. In a situation like that, if you can resolve it that way, that is the more memorable experience than, we rolled six times instead of failing three times and got them.
Yeah, we'll never remember that, but these guys always bring it up. So.
Yeah.
And even in my skill challenges, if you're, this min-maxer who gets a plus 20 to diplomacy at first level for min-maxing so that he can roll that die and always win, and that's what makes you happy, that's fine with me.
Yeah.
But
even in a skill challenge, which are basically determined by roles, if it were a diplomacy check, I would be, as a DM, I'd be asking them, what is it that you say to this person?
Exactly.
It wouldn't just be, okay, you made your check. That's not good enough. I need to know what it is that got you there.
But again, the game's different things to different people.
Yes.
And if you have someone who is the player, is introverted, and just wants to roll that die, and likes building the characters anyway,
yes.
If that's going to make them happy, it's about having fun. That's fine with me.
And you pretty much hit the theme of this entire seminar.
About having fun.
That it's about having fun, and it's about, as a DM, recognizing what's fun to your players and molding the game that you're playing to satisfy what they're looking for as well as satisfy what you're looking for. Everybody in the room should be having fun.
I encountered an interesting house rule that I wish I had time. It was a very short-looking house rule regarding action points. And the DM had invented a fairly simple system to encourage earlier use of action points, and he called it action point decay. And it simply boiled down to, if a player used an action point on the first round of a combat, they were available, the whole gamut of all actions were available to them, and anything involved a dice roll, they received a plus one bonus. By the time of the second turn, you could use the action point for everything, but you received no bonus. By the third turn, you were no longer allowed to use them for daily powers. Fourth turn, no longer allowed to use for daily and encounter powers. And what he kind of role-played this out was, the beginning of a combat, the players are full of energy, and they're usually ready to go or something. There's a lot of things happening, so you're going to see a lot more action in the combat. You further in, you're starting to see the combat get bogged down. It worked very well. I only played it for two sessions. It's not initially my house rule, but I thought it was a very interesting approach to getting players to use them sooner.
Yeah, I think that there is something to the idea that, particularly what you're saying about the first round and trying to incentivize players, you know, positively reinforcing the use of action points. One of the systems I have in my, house rule systems I have in my game is the fun point system, which is basically I have these points that I get award players for behaviors I want to encourage. It might be outside of game things like bringing food, arriving on time, being prepared. Writing up character backgrounds, or it might be things in-game like doing something really cool. I actually allow the players to reward each other with fun points. Fun points can then be turned in for sort of extra game rewards, bonuses to skill checks or attacks. Now I'm using fortune cards as a reward for that system. And I think that goes back to what I was saying earlier, is any ways that you can encourage good behavior in the players without increasing the complexity too much is a really good step you can take to improving your game.
A house rule that I have to increase the challenge of minions a little, especially once you start seeing a lot of auto damage come through, is that if power doesn't require an attack roll or a standard action to use it, something like magic missile, and it just bloodies the minion. They get a minus two to attacks and defenses, but are still around. More auto damage will kill it, or actually hitting it. Mm-hmm. That way you can still use minions and get the quick pop feel without somebody using Horde Masters Incendiary Detonation and just making it meaningless to have that, when they can just pull that out anytime.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll sympathize with that after, what was it that we always used, the cleric power, that the healing teat, we called it? What was that? It's the level one daily power that is the thing you move around and does damage to enemies and heals bloodied allies.
Yeah.
I don't remember. But yeah, and there's other, the fighter's got some powers like that too, where he's the mental image is he's just waving his sword around like this, whatever square he's going in, and just automatically killing everything that he comes next to. Yeah, so I might steal that idea. Thank you.
One of the things I started doing is using Aaliyah tools, and I would stack the Aaliyah tools below minions, and then like I had these Aladrin that were encased in this ice armor, and so every time they would hit one of these Aladrin minions, I'd remove a disc, and that would represent a hit on the minion. And so once they removed enough of the blue discs from below, that means the ice armor had shattered, and then they were just a standard minion. Or if they hit them with fire, it would remove two tokens instead of one, which kind of gives a more thematic element to giving minions extra hits. You could probably do the same thing with like giving them armor and just having a little gray disc below, and when they hit the first time, they have kind of shoddy armor, so it shatters, and then they're just a standard minion.
One of the tricks that I used, minions are one of my favorite places to play with monsters, and I love using them, as Greg knows. Like, I have no qualms about throwing scores of minions on the board to fight the characters. I just don't care.
Yeah, you might have heard earlier about his giant tub of miniatures. That's kind of when he...
But finding creative and novel ways to make them more interesting, or to give the leaders in the party ways to sort of bolster their minions. And one of the things I use is a leader power that basically gives minions temporary hit points. That lasts until whenever. And so or that give them resistance effectively. So you have to hit them with an attack that deals at least 8 points of damage or 10 points of damage. They still go down in one hit, but it's got to be something more substantial than just a, you know, a 5 area aura.
We've also used saving throws on minions. So basically, you hit it, you do damage, you take saving throw. If he does it, he doesn't die. And
It doesn't slow down the game too much.
It's still an easy mechanic, but
yeah,
that's particularly nice on something like a zombie that already has a mechanic like that, or other undead that you're an insubstantial creature where you might, when you swing through it, it might not die.
Right. Or at higher levels, you could do troll minions that you could only take down permanently with acid and fire. Otherwise,
solo minions that have action
points. Except I have to keep track of that, and I don't want to.
One mechanic we have on the player side is standing up. And you can stand up as a move action, or you can stand up as a minor action. If you stand up as a move action, you don't provoke opportunity attacks as in normal. But you can stand up as a minor, but you do provoke opportunity attacks.
That's an interesting one.
It's a way of keeping things moving a little more quickly and making characters make a choice about whether they're willing to take the attack. And if they're on the far end of the board, you can stand up as a minor and move into combat on the same turn. So it's one way of keeping people moving around the table.
That's really neat.
One thing we've also done is not necessarily break the actions as move, minor, standard. So, for example, if a player wants to move through and he's running and he wants to bust through that door, he'll run, do a minor to break the door through, and then just keep on going. So you don't have to actually have that. It allows them more flexibility to what they want to do.
I think that
Second Wind is as a move, but you don't get the defense bonus. That's an option.
I think that gets at something that is at the core of expert DMing, which is giving the players interesting choices. I will often, if the players want to do something, use the actions as sort of ways to modulate the difficulty of it. If they want to do something as just a minor, it's going to be a hard DC instead of a moderate DC, or it might be a moderate instead of an easy DC. Because it's not fun in a lot of times to have to spend your standard action to do certain things, as whether it's Second Wind or a skill check or whatever, but taking advantage of that minor action to allow you to give them sort of a gamble that, and sometimes it's not going to pay off, but at least all they wasted was a minor.
To kind of build upon your comment too, Greg, I think that's very important to apply. An earlier question was asked, when you have a situation or encounter where the DM is wanting the players to do X, Y, and then accomplish Z, I think it's really important to build multiple paths into that, and you'll often find that the players aren't going to be as far away from what you're wanting if you allow them that flexibility before they encounter what you're to do.
Totally.
I was trying to encourage my players to do skill checks in combat, and so I usually make skill checks either a minor action or a free action, kind of depending on what they're trying to do.
I do that a lot, too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for instance, the player might want to try to diplomatize or intimidate with one of the monsters, but they don't necessarily want to gamble on using their standard action to do it, which could potentially slow down combat. So, allow them to do it as a minor, or allow them to do it as a minor if it raises the DC. Any other interesting house rules?
Okay. Are there any specific questions you wanted to ask us? We have some more that we can sort of ask you for conversation starters. But
if you got a long running campaign, but you've agreed to rotate DMs so nobody gets burned out, how do you deal with the varying DM styles from one DM to the other?
How do you deal with varying DM styles in a multi DM campaign? I've actually never run a multi DM campaign. So anything I tell you would be purely sort of textbook answer, not practical.
I have been in one where I was sharing DM responsibilities. At that point, I was running much more dungeon delve-y type adventures, and he was running much more of the story. And so trying to recognize where your skills lie and divide up the responsibilities based on that is a first step, but you still have the challenge that the players might be, you might have a group of entirely storytellers, the storyteller player type, and if you you know, then one of the DMs takes over and it's all dungeon delves, it's going to be a challenge because that's not what they're going to enjoy. So if you are rotating DMs, being cognizant of your own DMing style and trying to figure out ways to match that to what the players want. There's also the challenge of trying to, especially if you are one of you're rotating in and out as players, trying to not give away everything. Like, if I was to take over DMing in Chris's campaign and I was his player, I would find out all of these various secrets that he has, and that's obviously not something you necessarily want to accomplish. So trying to figure out ways to communicate enough information to give over the DM mantle to somebody else without giving away all the secrets is...
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd want to inflict that on another DM.
I don't think so.
There's thousands of NPCs in my campaign and more plot threads than I can... that anybody can reasonably want to have to deal with.
So I don't know if that answers your question exactly, but...
Does anybody here in the room have any thoughts about that, about the double DM experience?
The question was that two different DMs run the same campaign?
That's it.
It could be whether it's a home campaign or, say, like it's a pre-bought, say, like Scale of War or Dungeon of War. Yeah. You know, you go to the store, you get it, and go to
the store. But it's basically, it's the same party of adventurers in the same environment.
Right.
Why would you prefer that to just alternating different campaigns every week?
Oh, a lot of time in this.
Because
your players are invested in their characters and they don't want to change. If you're going to play group styles that are that way instead of the people that like to play different characters all the time.
I just wouldn't even do that. But I mean, I don't care. Whatever you got, do what you like. I'm not. No judgment.
There are some, you know, where you'd be like from 1 to 30, but you know the one guy doesn't want to DM from all the time because he wants to play, and other ones do. So you get the idea of, okay, well, I'll do if it's like a pre-bought one or be made, you'll be like, okay, I'll do this section, you'll do this section, and then you'll do that section. With a home campaign, it would be a lot more difficult,
right?
Because, you know, you'd have to
There's a game out there that Robin Laws wrote called Rune that you actually share storytelling duties. One idea that you can do that came up, and I thank you for this question, you kind of inspired me for a future campaign, is that you have your group of adventurers, but whoever's the DM is it actually represents some kind of faction within the overall story. So that when it goes to another DM, you're not sharing secrets, it's just it's competing forces that, just happen to, the players are in the center of this ongoing story. So it doesn't matter if this DM comes up with something crazy, because it represents, say, like a god. Gods are battling with each other, and the DM kind of represents that faction, and the players are kind of stuck in the middle. So that way you can kind of pass the DM duty and get back to being a player, but not necessarily knowing everything that's going on.
I think that also gets at the idea of looking for natural breaks in the story to transition those responsibilities. Sort of looking ahead, and you might be kind of exhausted DMing, and so you're thinking about passing off the mantle to somebody else. So you think, in two sessions they're going to be kind of concluding the current adventure arc. Start talking to the other DM about taking over the responsibility and start providing those threads whatever they want to cover in their section of the campaign. Let's go with Sean.
I'm the campaign that's doing exactly that. We're on our third DM in about a year and a half. It's against the Giants, or the Runs of the Giants, but each DM that takes over takes it in a different direction. Mm-hmm. It's actually refreshing because, one DM might emphasize this, and then after 6 months, we're getting a little tired of that. The new DM says, okay, here we go, ready? And then we're off in a different direction. And it's refreshing. It's a different play style every 6 months. Different thoughts, different ideas, different directions, and it works for us.
I have a quick question about that, but first...
You can break it down also by geographic locations in the campaign world. So, for example, one GM is going to go take care of this geographic location. When he's done, then the players move to a different geographic location. Another DM takes over. The stories between them don't really have to match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing I wanted to inject in response to that, which is sounds like a lot of fun, actually, is the question I have for DMs out there in the audience is, how do you integrate characters, or how do you phase characters in and out of your game? Are you more of the sort of hand wave, the character just appears, you know, he was not here last week, but he's here this week, or is it, do you require the players to actually tell you what they've been doing, or where they were, or why they slept through the last combat? How do you sort of build that in?
Phase. Log in and out.
I kind of phase him into the background. Like, our last game session, the rogue was gone. He was sick. So instead of just pretending he wasn't there or asking him, I kind of used his characters just as an NPC.
So do you actually run him actively, or?
Not actively. He's a gnome. He likes shiny things. So basically I said that while the party was actually doing important things, he was, you know, pilfering around
right.
or whatever. And then when they needed a lockpick, I would roll his thievery check, and if he didn't, then that was it. And he kind of just served as like a very marginal utility. And then
right.
in the adventure log, you know, I wrote that in, and the next game I kind of recap for him, and that was it. But it works for us.
Using the companion rules, I'll make an NPC stat block for certain PCs.
Yeah.
I'm kind of giving away to some of my party. I'm going to start doing that with these guys. But we have one guy, Joe, who's always late because he's always working late, or he's just a slow guy. So there's kind of a comic relief that he's always, you know, he's playing a mole gladiator, so he's always running in, you know, half drunk, and then I pull him into combat.
So do you play? Do you play the companion, or do you give it to one of your players?
Well, there's two things. Either I play the companion, or for management purposes, I'll hand that to someone else. Or, well, you got to be careful with that too, because then.
I tell you what would happen in my campaign.
I would never do that in my Garson campaign.
That character would become the party trap detective.
Exactly. I mean, you want to keep them integrated, especially if they're going in or through the middle of the dungeon. You can't be like, oh, Bob decided to run all the way back up and everything like that. So anyway, so the NPC stat block is kind of cool. But no, you just made me... No, I never want to give that
but
to another.
Definitely the companion rules that we got in the DMG2, is that right?
Yeah.
Are very handy for building simplified versions of player characters that the DM can keep around for things like the fundamentally, I just want them around for thievery checks, because they provide a critical party skill. I will often use characters who aren't present as plot devices. I often talk about Bruce Cordell's tiefling warlock. Bruce had been absent for a session, and his character had wandered off the previous session to basically take care of some shopping stuff. So in the session which he was not there, some villains that had been haranguing the party basically showed up and threw a bloody bag at their feet. The contents of which consisted of one tiefling head. When Bruce learned the next day the fate of his character, he was horribly, horribly distraught until I told him that, no, don't worry, this is all going somewhere, and that he wouldn't be necessarily gone forever.
I think what that sets on is, if you've got a really good way to integrate an absence into the story, I think it's a great way to deal with player absences. I just did something similar in my Darkson campaign where Chris Tulloch was out, and the players were kind of... He had gone off on his own the previous session, and so the players were just kind of proceeding without him, and they were going through this dungeon. They arrive in a jail where they actually find his character. And Chris doesn't know this yet, but...
don't tweet it!
But he basically, next session, I'm going to have him come an hour early, and we're going to play through the events that lead up to his imprisonment as a way to span that time. It does mean railroading him a little bit, but, you know, that's what you get for missing it.
Does anybody in the audience do cutscenes, like, effectively, where you might have a character off doing his own thing, and you just sort of periodically jump back and forth between one character doing something and the rest of the party? Yeah? Okay.
Alternatively, in Jeremy Crawford's game, I'll give over my character wholesale to one of the other players in the group.
You're very brave.
Well, I have 14 or 16 healing surges, and...
Oh, they're not going to kill you.
Yeah, twice as many hit points as most of them, so... but that's also because Chris Sims is in the game, if you know him, and he he's a good role player. He understands the character, and so I'm comfortable giving that character to him. It's not too complicated of a character. It's a warden. That obviously is a call each player has to make in each group, whether you think that somebody else can handle the role playing and the mechanical responsibilities of playing the character.
What if you just go back to the alternating DM thing?
Yeah.
We had it once where we had a DM who just had to be out for 3 weeks or whatever it was. So we didn't want to go too far, you know, into another campaign or anything. So what we did was we did a short prequel.
Oh, that's very clever.
Especially one of the characters who was really important and was pretty invested in her character. And we actually got a little information from another one. And so we ran this sort of prequel adventure of her, a younger her, and brought in some plot details.
Did she die? Because that'd be really awkward.
She didn't die.
Okay.
But it turned out really interesting because it sort of nurtured the main campaign because it gave out information that so that later on in the main campaign when she runs into this person, at some moment she has this, aha, wait a minute, I knew something about this person from years ago when I was at so-and-so. So it's one way of incorporating something small into the campaign.
Yeah. As far as characters who are players who are absent, anybody else have anything that they do with those? Yeah.
Well, I had one guy who was too hungover one day to show up. So we started the game saying that in the last battle from our previous session that he actually just got beaten up real bad.
Okay.
And they were all in prison, and an NPC was going to come in and rescue them and help them escape from prison. And I expected the players to just kind of leave, or, you know, leave and drag him along with them, because they can't just leave their buddy behind. But then they just left and left him in prison.
Nice.
So I then, it actually inspired me, and I then after the fact, through email, role-played that scene out with him, where he turned evil and was recruited by a lich, and then was secretly working against the player. And then that helped weave that into the final climax of that arc of the adventure.
Yeah.
And it was pretty fun.
Monty Cook, I remember doing something similar like that in the Tallest campaign. I can't remember the specific details. All I know is that Sean Reynolds was absent or something, and his character got possessed during his absence. And that pretty much was a secret up until the last encounter, when whatever was inside of him came out and started attacking us. That's sort of a thing that DMs will often do too when players are away, is they'll use the what I call the ye old doppelganger trick. How many people have actually worked with a player to have them deceive the rest of the party?
My entire Darkson.
all the players are playing doppelgangers. Yeah. Okay. Just checking. It's fun to give characters to give players that opportunity to, if not turn it evil, at least have to make tough moral.
You kind of have to watch. You kind of have to watch that. I mean, it's a real trick as a DM, because you don't want the campaign to degenerate. You ultimately don't want the players being adversarial to each other constantly. Mm-hmm. Because that could destroy the game. You have to have the right player mindset to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it feels like you're ganging up on the other players.
So. I had a memorable one on that where the player was taken captive, and he awakens to a person drinking a potion and turning into him. And so he immediately begins speaking to the guy with a lisp, which his character didn't do. And I said, okay, go back out, speak with a lisp the entire time, and gather up all their magic items to cast a ritual that will then you'll turn invisible and bring it back to the enemies.
Huh.
And they didn't catch on to the list.
They just thought the player had some dental work that day or something.
That just didn't catch it.
Okay.
One of the things I did in my last campaign was to, there was a warlock. He was a new player. He had none of the assumptions about D&D that many of us have. He didn't know what the Hand of Vecna was. He didn't know who Therizdun was. So he was carrying around this orb for 20 levels that had a fragment of Therizdun in it that kept giving him more power. And as long as he kept using the orb, it was giving Therizdun more power to eventually break free of his prison. Eventually, this became apparent. And this gets at something that I think is tricky when you're going to is part of the trick with running a sort of morally ambiguous character is making sure that they, if you're going to introduce potential treachery into the campaign, allow the characters to allow the character to feel involved in the group, so that by the time they're making that tough choice, by the time they're making that choice, it's a tough one.
It's not a gimme that they're just going to betray the party.
Yeah, and ultimately he chose to give up on his pact with Therizdun and become a vampire with a pact to Kos and put on the Hand of Vecna, and I don't know, whatever. But
do any of you DMs have players who cry when their characters die?
Cry metaphorically or, you know, literally.
Yeah. Because in a situation where, you know, there might be some division between the party because of the way the characters have chosen their alignments or whatever, sometimes I'll have a conversation with a player fairly early on about that character's exit strategy, which is to say a conversation about, you know, based on what the party dynamic is right now, your character, under certain circumstances, might not be long for this world. I'm just saying. So that they're sort of braced for the possibility that they may have to conceptualize another character if things go certain ways. Or this conversation is also good to happen when you feel like you're getting to the when the player feels like he's getting to the conclusion of his character's story arc. And coming up with cool ways for that character to actually exit in a way that's memorable and dramatic. I have those conversations with my players all the time. I was just wondering if anybody else did.
Chris, why didn't you warn me that you're going to make a purple dragon make me jump off a 100-foot cliff then?
Some things just happen.
You passed it that day?
No, I was there. It just dominated me and woo!
You know, see you later.
We can learn your best.
In that campaign I'm in now, yeah, most of the characters are the morally ambiguous types, except for mine, playing this good, you know, dwarf invoker. And they're like, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to torture this guy. I'm like, no, you can't torture him, no, question him, intimidate him, don't torture him, or, oh, we're going to do this. I'm like, no. I'm trying to be the moral the compass of this group of morally ambiguous people. I'm like, and sometimes
yeah,
it doesn't go all my direction, but
yeah,
it doesn't come into actual.
My Wednesday group is pretty morally ambiguous, except for the Dragonborn Paladin, played by Trevor Kidd, and he's in exactly the same position you are. So, and he doesn't want to go evil, and he doesn't want to be like them, so it's an interesting tension.
Interesting, just it's more anecdotal than anything, but rather than having players cry about the death of their players, I've had other players get really upset when a given character dies.
Interesting.
So that you, in a sense, you sort of know you've been doing something right.
Yeah, and, yeah. They're
really distraught when one of their party members dies, you know, in some tragic way. And it's really fun because you have the sense of, yeah, that worked.
It totally is fun. There was like early on in the Monday group, Michelle Carter, who's the leader of the party, she's the warlord. She made an attack against a bad guy that the bad guy redirected. And it redirected it into one of her allies, and she crit with the attack and speared her ally through the chest with her spear, killing him, like dropping him to his negative bloodied value. I think that was a particularly damaging, scarring moment in her career as a warlord. And, you know, player came back next week with a new character. That was it. It was just hilarious.
Speaking of Michelle, in one of my games, she was playing a paladin, and she was really the only moral character in the group. And it really is something you have to be careful about when you're in that situation where there's a lot of morally ambiguous characters with just one who is sort of the moral compass, because that character can end up feeling a little bit like they're constantly mothering them,
they're the party pooper.
Yeah, exactly. And so if somebody's doing that, I think it's important to, you know, you as a DM to talk to the player, make sure they're okay with that. And if they're not, talk about what solutions you might be able to develop, whether there's something that perhaps that person decides to leave the party for some reason, or that they become corrupted by all of this.
Or conversely, good things happen to the party because of their presence.
Exactly.
You know, you've got a paladin in the party, so we're not going to arrest you. You get to skirt by because you've got a paladin in your party. We don't care that you burned this guy to death and, you know, raised his store to the ground. You've got a paladin in the party. You're
you
forgiven.
Look like the trustworthy sort.
They'll probably take the paladin aside and go, you need to work harder on these guys.
build upon Brent's comment about players crying about other players, I actually was part of Brent's gaming group until about a year ago. And our DM had an excellent way of removing my character from the campaign and introducing, it was actually Brent's wife's character at the time. And I thought the way he handled this was very graceful, and I thought it was inspiring. He brought the new character in before I left, so it was situational. He wasn't able to do that. And what happened was we encountered a small skill challenge where my character actually saved Brent's wife's character from drowning in the river, and I died in the process. And it was really a way of bringing the new character into the group and making her immediately have an emotional investment within the party while having me exit, and she even had an emotional attachment to me. And it was very, very well done. I thought that was an excellent way.
Very nice.
Character death is actually something that really bothers me as a DM. As a player,
get over it!
We don't call him TPK Perkins for nothing.
As a player, it really doesn't bother me that I die a lot in this game.
It's your decision.
Well, it can get annoying if it's too much, but every single time I die, it's in character, so I don't care.
Right. Yeah.
But as a DM, and a DM does a lot of LFR, where I can't just say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, maybe we're just not compatible. You got to take the players you have, and you have to. It's just the nature of it. I get a lot of people, and remember, this is all about making sure people have fun.
Absolutely.
A lot of people who do not want the characters to die. I don't understand. No risk, no reward to me, but that's, you know, no judgments, right? And so I decided for a long time that I would just make sure that I never kill characters in LFR. Never. I refuse to do it. I roll a 20. I say it's a 4. And I make sure no character dies. But I think when you do that, it's obvious you're doing that. Or it can be. And then what about the players who say, but then there's no risk, no reward? You know, it's just one. This is an issue where your differing play styles are a problem for me as a DM. I can't cater to everybody. So how do I cater to everybody, guys?
I think the way, in the case of a D&D game, I think there's an expectation, or there should be an expectation set up forth, that the challenges in this adventure or whatever are lethal. That death is a real factor of D&D, and it drives a great deal of story in D&D. Now, we have workarounds to that with raised dead spells and stuff like that. And I use that as sort of a crutch for the player who does not want to give up the character. There's always a way to bring a character back. It's like a comic book series. You know, Spider-Man is never truly dead. Captain America is never truly dead. In this type of campaign, where you've got players who want to play a certain character and that's what's fun to them, they want to play just this character, I don't mind opening up these doors which say there is a way in the campaign that your character can come back, but fill in that space. There's some consequence, perhaps to the party, perhaps to the character. There's something that they have to accept as a trade-off. They get what they want, the story gets what it wants, and the other players feel like, we don't want to die because we wouldn't want to have to face that consequence.
Real quick follow-up. But I still have to deal with the fact that psychologically people feel like they failed when they died. And it's not enough. LFR has great rules. You want to come back, come back. But still, you have some people who are like, but I died. I failed.
It doesn't have to be cast that way, though.
So, two things about that. One is, particularly for organized play events or what I've been doing in playtests and such, is I've actually been borrowing a little bit from video games and saying, well, you can play this on normal, hard, or nightmare mode. And that kind of throwing that out ahead of time sets up an expectation of what the game is going to be like. Now, with that being said, that's not always going to work. One of the things I think you can do to make the death not feel like a failure is to craft the events or the encounters to make it the death feel rewarding in some way. This can mean adapting a monster so that it, if it's like you said with your your redirecting attack, give a monster a chance to attack somebody, but allow somebody who's nearby to throw their body in front of them to basically suffer the attack if they want.
That was a house rule I learned from Monty Cook. In his campaign, he would always say you can always take damage for another character. If you're reasonably within distance of doing so, you can always do it regardless of what the rules say.
Yeah. Now, or just making sure that if you're describing how character is, if the monster's bringing around an axe, that you talk about how you raise your shield and but it splinters through and it cleaves you in two or whatever. But try not to just you take ongoing damage and fall down and die.
another cool tip is I use for I've used in a couple cases that should be kind of good is give that character like another round after they've died. Basically, they're sort of their death scene.
Yeah.
They're essentially dead, but now they get a round to do whatever they want, standard action, move, minor, whatever however you want to swing it, depending on the situation. And they can do things like make a final death attack or utter some curse that my evil twin is going to come and hunt you down. And so they can play, the same character again. But give them that they're dead, but they've got another round where they can pretty much do whatever they want, and they get that moment of heroism.
I did that with an NPC, and the characters tried to heal him, and I wouldn't let it happen. They were very upset. Very, very upset that they couldn't rescue the NPC's death scene.
There's one thing where, if the guy's playing his character and he dies, well, yeah, that's bad. But the guy does something really dumb. Like, you got the squishy mage that runs up to the bad guys, and then goes, oh, smack, and just takes out the mage in one hit. Well, you're being dumb, and I don't feel too bad about, killing that character. There's one instance where we're playing, the squishy character. He's like, oh, there's the tree we got to get to on the outside of the room. And they have, like, two columns there. So he goes, runs around, goes up to him, like, well, okay, there's a guy here, there's a guy here, there's three guys down there. He goes, well, I'm going to run all the way up there. I'm like, are you sure you want to do that? Oh, yeah. I'm like, okay, go ahead. And I attack him all the way. And then he's like, how come you're attacking me? Well, you just ran right up there.
It's the reward for silly behavior.
Yeah.
Well, by the way, just on the very quick thing on the topic of character death sympathy, like the sympathy that other players feel for when a character dies, I cannot tell you how many emails I got from the community when Will Wheaton's character died falling into that acid pit and how horrible of a person I was. I was a terrible, terrible, rotten person for causing that to happen. And there are some people that still have not forgiven me for that and remind me of it regularly.
Like Will Wheaton.
Will is like the only one who doesn't.
Will is
he was totally cool about it. Yeah.
But as a follow-up, that gave you a plot point to create something past that point.
Yes.
So death doesn't have to be the final
exactly.
answer. You can have somebody maimed, loses his arm, and all of a sudden his whole plot becomes, I want to recover my arm. Something
yep.
like that. So there's always something past that point.
Yeah, they would never have met, the Hell Beast and Rad Longhammer if they hadn't,
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So, back there.
Another way of using your action point is sacrificing yourself for another person, right? So you can use your
action that's an interesting
to take
idea.
Damage for someone else, right? So you can do something heroic, and it has to be role play based. It can't be, I spend my action point and take the 6 points of damage. No.
Yeah.
Tell me what you do. Exactly what you were saying, my shield splinters, et cetera, et cetera. So that's
very
one
cool.
way of using an action point. The other thing was that something our DM did for us a while ago was a TPK. except
you
for
playing
one
with
character,
Chris?
My character was sort of, through a circumstance, sort of observed the rest of the group dying. And it was, in a sense, the TPK was the result of a few bad decisions. Alright? So there's,
yeah.
you have a, as a DM, you have sort of, now do I hand wave this and kind of, because we had a long running campaign and everyone's invested in it, you have a TPK, well, what do you now do? Right? Do you hand wave it? And so on. So what he did was he,
they all woke up in the shower together.
They woke up up in a cell, and then each of them was taken out and tortured and had some significant part of their character removed. The warlord
oh my God.
Cut out.
Wow, that's hardcore.
And so on. But essentially what had to happen was the group had to come together.
Yeah.
How are we going to overcome this crisis? And it actually turned into a really interesting plot device.
That's a brilliant thing for DMs to keep in mind, too, is when the whole party goes down, they're, you know, they're bleeding out. They're not necessarily all dead.
Yeah. Enemies just stabilize them.
Exactly. Enemies can stabilize them and take them wherever they want to, and off you go. Brilliant start to a
new one of the great things about Dark Sun is no humanoid is going to just outright kill you. They're going to take you and make you a slave.
Yeah.
or eat you.
But then you wake up in a boiling pot of stew, and that's interesting as well.
I should probably preface this with saying that Brent and I shared the same DM, and we might as well admit he is a drama teacher, so improvisational skills are his forte. He was excellent, but I had a long discussion with him about the death of my character and how he handled it. I was very impressed with it, and he hit upon a really key point that has stuck in my mind ever since. It has actually helped me quite a bit. He said that one of the caveats of D&D 4th edition is don't split the party, and he said one of the other effects of that should be telling the DM to keep the players focused on keeping the party together. So there's a lot of things that can be done to avoid the character death and the sympathy and the also emotional investment. One of the good ideas I heard from a good friend of mine recently was, prior to character death, what can you do to set character expectation on the death? And a good idea was, have the characters discuss, well, hey, what happens if I do die?
Mm-hmm.
And it could be something as simplistic as, I'm going to give all my magic items to the mage or something like that. But the more you set the character's expectations for death is going to happen eventually, what are you going to do about it? When it does happen, it's a lot easier. Also, too, using character death as a way of reinforcing party cohesion. And my DM did a fine example of that, because my death, not only did I walk away from it saying, I actually feel good about leaving this party and seeing that they're going to be brought closer together because of my death, it also had the added effect of making the party move in closer and bring in a new member and accept the welcome mark. So the more you can do to have the party focus back upon itself.
I always encourage players to look at death as an opportunity to play something new and to figure out a creative way to integrate some new element to this party. Often a party will become pretty set and the players will understand their roles, and things get very interesting when you take one piece out and you put another piece in. What happens to that dynamic?
A lot of the players who do feel that emotion that you were describing, they just cannot handle losing this player they're so invested in. It's because they have made all these future plans for the character, none of which involve death.
Right.
So if you focus them back and say, this is going to happen, what are you going to do about it?
That's interesting.
More often, it's going to help them deal with that a little bit easier, too.
I think with young players, very young players, 8-10-year-old characters, players,
you do have to be mindful of the age of the players. I will say that right out the bat. Like, I am not going to kill any 8-year-old girl's character, particularly if I've only met her like 2 hours ago. Okay.
What if she's not 18?
That's a long
character.
I think cutting
your
feet off is worse than killing
Unless she's a really terrible little child. No, I'm just not going to do it. That's just being sort of aware of your player audience. But
I'd kill my 8-year-old.
And we haven't recorded.
But a lot of that goes back to the social contract you come to the table with. We've kind of touched on a lot, but as a DM, as an expert DM, being cognizant of the social contract you have with the players, and that might not be the same contract with every single player at your table, but one of the things I always try to emphasize in these type of seminars is communication with your players. It's really easy to just do your planning, they show up, and that's it. And, you might talk to them about the adventure, but actually talking to them, as a person, what they want for their character, what they want out of the game, what they hope to...
And frankly, what you want out of the game.
Yeah.
That's all part of the social contract, too.
Exactly.
And what the other players want out of the game, because people will end up with players who are disruptive, who who make it less fun for the other players and you in the group because they don't understand what the social contract is.
Yeah. I mean, being a DM is a little bit like being a social worker sometimes. you are balancing a lot of different desires, a lot of different wants from different people, including yourself, and trying to reconcile those, especially when they seem unreconcilable, is challenging.
Yeah.
How do you handle disruptive players at your table who just want to talk about, when it's not their turn, something in their social life? Like, oh, we're going to talk about the football game. That's going to happen.
One of the quick things I have is there are certain sort of key phrases I use. I just very pointedly ask them, what do you do? You know, what's your action? If they're talking, I interrupt them, and I just keep it moving. There's like certain phrases that I use to just sort of drive them into the game constantly.
They're active on their initiative.
Right.
But when it's not their initiative, they don't have a respect for the people around them.
I just say, hey, guys, can it?
Yeah. If there's a persistently disruptive person, I will eventually ask them to leave the game. And that sounds that sounds mean, but...
Sometimes I'll just stop and I'll just look at them.
I remember that happening a few times.
Silence is often the best weapon.
Yeah.
A DM has.
With kids, it's really hard.
Yeah.
I think you also need to recognize, though, that there are certain rhythms within a game, and it's okay, like, you know, if you've just had sort of 2 hours of, you know, intense role-playing and combat, that there might be a little bit, players might need a little bit of time to unwind a bit. Encouraging players to come half an hour before the game, letting them talk so that when your start time hits, you know, you get the game going, and talking is done. They've got a lot of it out of their system.
One of the things that we did in our game is I have a group that normally only gets together like once a month.
Mm-hmm.
That specific group only gets together once a month. And really, we get together to be together. It's not, we play as part of it, but a lot of it is there's a lot of bullshitting around the table.
Yeah.
But what we do is we try to come in early and get a lot of that out of our systems. And when we start the game, it pretty much flows that way. And there's bullshitting there every once in a while, but it's not as prevalent if you take care of it either before or, you know, you choose a break and do that in between.
Yeah, you have to accept some amount of that just because some character will have a bad night and they'll roll three runs in a roll and suddenly the game will degenerate for a time while that person is getting ragged on.
Alternatively, you could just play Gamma World, which is basically... but that actually sets on a good point, which is you want to... It's important to establish the tone of your game. If the players... this goes back to the social contract. If the players going into it recognize that you run a fairly serious game or a horror game or a dramatic or whatever, that at least helps set the expectations a bit.
Yeah, if your innkeeper is named Mr. Poo Poo Pants, the players are going to respond to that with a certain gaming style.
Yeah,
shall we say? So your campaign has to sort of reflect the tenor of, that you want to achieve as well.
I just have another issue that's bugged me. Not as serious as the character death, but it's bugged me. Trying to find a solution. That's game transparency. That's the title of that article in Dragon a while back. And my particular approach is...
Do you tell them it's a minion or not? That kind of game transparency?
That is exactly what bugs me. Is that one particular one, because if you roll a 15 on your knowledge check, you're entitled to that whole line. And I like to say they're rabble. And... You know, I think most people...
You sort of couch it in terms that sort of fit within the world that the characters can identify with.
Right, and most people would say, he's got a little bit of fire resistance. It won't say 5. Or, really, you should not be hitting him with fire. You might get a little through, but you shouldn't. That tells you a 15. And that's the way I like to handle it. But some people want to know. No, tell me it's a minion. I'm a controller. Tell me if it's a minion. I need to know. And, it's just another example where differing play styles at the same table could be a threat, and in LFR, you're with or you're with.
It doesn't hurt my campaign or my belief in my campaign and its sort of value to the players to tell them it's a minion. There are times when I won't, because I think there's a dramatic reason not to. I want them to discover. I want that discovery. And there are other times when I just say, for this encounter, I'm just going to tell them minion, 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 because I'm going to assume that their players can sort of recognize the guy who is holding his sword properly versus the ones who are like going it's a judgment call every time. I don't fix on one or the other. It's purely a judgment call based on what I think is appropriate knowledge for the encounter, because that the only time I will withhold that knowledge if I think it's interesting to the encounter to do so.
I was just going to add, it's not fun for the player if they're spending their dailies on killing a minion, or you know that. Yeah, I mean, and so I think that the transparency really requires a judgment call on the part of the DM, but ultimately that's when I think where it does sort of lie in the DM's court, and you should typically go with what you prefer. And
now, if the players are the type who are aggravated about knowing that kind of knowledge, then obviously you'd go the other way.
Yeah, because that's not hurting you, but I think if they are demanding transparency of you and you are not, and that is not your DMing style, then if it bothers you, then DM it the way you want.
It never bothers me.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure everybody's having a good time, because that does not affect my good time.
Right? Yeah.
Whether I tell them it's a minion or not.
Yeah.
I'm just balancing the interests of multiple players.
Yeah. That's
my
that's
in that case, I would just be telling them it's minions, and if any of your players seem bothered by that, then you can couch it slightly differently next time and say...
You can give a sort of prosaic kind of description.
Yes, that's exactly it. And you read into that minion. Yeah.
Destin?
That's basically what I was going to say, too, is I oftentimes start by couching it as well. And if I see that the players are just giving me a blank look,
right,
or they're kind of giving me that...
You see the bad guy, you know, bossing around a bunch of peons who come running at you. That word and phrasing just tells you, okay.
If for some reason they're not getting that, or if they want to know, is it 5 resistance, 10 resistance, then I'll start with, it's a little bit of resistance. And if I just kind of am getting that blank look from players, or a quizzical look from players, I just want to know more, then I'll put it kind of as a side, yes, that's like 5 resist. Or whatever. So that way you get them first, and then
you tell them you don't think that power that they're thinking about using is going to burn through the resistance.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I always tell them minions are for the same reason that I tell them that they're bloody, because I feel like it's a mechanic that they need to know. It helps them strategize and play the game better. And for the same reason, I don't use a DM screen, because I just want to be completely transparent to my players.
That's really interesting. How many people here who are DMs do not use DM screens?
50. Wow. Wow. Good number of you.
No offense, it's a great product.
I have a screen on my table. It's off to the side where it's hiding my drink.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the tables if I need to really refer to something very quickly, but, if I kill one of my children, I want them to know it was the dice, really.
Yes.
I'm playing with a bunch of noobs. I want them to know they can trust me to play.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's something there, because with my home group, I'll keep a DM screen because I want to balance the tension based on the rolls, and I will change dice rolls to modify the tension. But... with that being said,
I will never change dice rolls.
Yeah, I know.
Let the dice fall where they may.
But I also run I run a very story-heavy campaign, and I am not going to let some mundane creature kill off one of the characters that the player has poured all this investment into. However, there are times...
I might change a monster's stats, change their armor class or something, change their hit points,
right,
change how much damage they do, but I'm not going to change a dire roll.
I typically use a screen. Mostly it's to keep my notes obscured. I don't care so much about the dice rolls. And I tend to roll my dice rolls privately, but there is a fair amount of conviction among my players that my dice rolls are what they are, good or bad. If it's been called into question, it hasn't been brought to my face.
You can also use the DM screen as an opportunity to create drama in dice rolls, though, when you want to make a saving throw particularly important, or you want to make a recharge particularly important. Even if you play it by the numbers and you've been rolling the whole time behind the screen, then having the contrast of rolling that out there creates immediately draws everybody into the table.
Sometimes I will have my players roll my rolls for me. Does the dragon recharge its breath weapon when three of the characters are at three hit points? Matt, why don't you roll a d6 for me? If you roll a 5 or a 6, let me know. And they're all like, oh, shit. Yeah, exactly.
Let them have a player screen in that case.
Yes. Yeah, I find that using a screen or not using a screen is very dependent, again, on mood and table. Again, being primarily an LFR judge, you know, some groups like not knowing what the rules are. Some like seeing every role, and sometimes it's, like you mentioned, it's a matter of building tension. Sometimes a secret role is very tense. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a public role is very tense. It's just a matter of what's going to really engage players.
I think part of being a good DM is recognizing when those opportunities come, when those dramatic moments come, and paying it off with a trick like that.
For me, for my campaign anyway, the players have a kind of iconic attachment to the Dungeon Master screen, so that it has a kind of little play in that.
Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, I used to obscure my notes, too, because, you know, I was very story heavy, and for a while there, I had a son who was always trying to be around. And it has a photographic memory on. But anyways, but it does have this kind of, I don't know, almost nostalgic, iconic value that we're playing now.
Yeah. I think you know, I had a thought about that over the weekend, like doing one that was like this tall, but had a sort of tilted inside so you could still read it without having to go down like that. I think there's something there. I think there's something to that.
It's physically too tall for me.
It's the perfect height.
Yeah. More so than hiding dice rolls. I'm just about...
Yeah, even though we dropped it on its the new ones on their side, so they're landscape, they're still... Still
making it one side.
definitely keep doing awesome artwork, because I definitely, when I was running them in the Underdark, had that screen all the way out every game.
Mm-hmm.
I'm buying the new GF9. I love that. That's just gorgeous.
Oh, that's an awesome idea. That'd be an awesome idea. Just have like a bunch of pieces of art, like a print on demand, so you can have a different screen for whatever types of adventure you're running. Like,
saying that, for, I think what I really wish we had a DM screen for the Feywild, for the Underdark, for the Shadowfell, for the world.
You don't have to. You just have to have the art. We can print it off in landscape mode.
Yeah.
tape it to the DM screen.
Make an entrance.
I use the iPad. I get a scene of, especially when I do like Dark Center stuff. You just put that up, and you can leave that up. Have your information and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I use MasterPlan and have a screen, an actual just flat front screen here.
Oh wow!
Throw pictures onto it.
Nice.
And
why not? One on a DM screen with picture frames in the front instead of any artwork at all, so you can just
Just slide things in. That's brilliant. My idea now. Thank you. Circle R.
How many people use computers at the table now? How many DMs are as DMs? About half, yeah. Yeah, it's something I've definitely begun using. Just keeping a large Word document open that contains almost all of my notes, mm-hmm. As well as the digital tools are obviously useful as well. One of the tricks I've started using is if I'm pulling monster stat blocks from a lot of different sources, using the compendium to basically do screenshots and pour them all into one document so that I'm not having to flip between three or four different books at a time.
I actually set a rule where no computers allowed at the table. I felt like if my players had laptops open, it was a constant distraction, and it slowed everything down. And so, to be fair, I say I don't use computers.
Yeah, because they're tweeting all the time.
Yeah,
I'm the only one who's allowed to do that.
I've gotten used to the tweeting. It was first very unsettling to me with my players, but I guess it just sort of went.
It depends on your players, of course. If your players are still engaged.
Oh yeah, that's true. Mine use their tweets to talk about how often they get killed. Yeah.
If they're ready on their turn, I'm not going to care too much what they're doing off of their turn, as long as it's not distracting the other players as well.
Yeah, I think it depends on the players too. Like I myself talking earlier about you know, letting people, you know, tell me your action, and then I'm going to move on to the next guy while you roll your damage. I can multitask like that too. I have to accept the fact that a lot of my players can too. They can still be tweeting But they're still listening to the story, they're still engaged, they still know what's going on. I think it's only fair that if I'm doing multitasking, if they're capable of doing it too, they have that opportunity.
It's a player-by-player thing, like you say. Like, you know, I got one character, one player, you know, Matt Smith, his character will probably fall unconscious 3 or 4 times during a session. So he just needs, he'll occasionally send off tweets or stuff while he's lying there not doing anything, and that doesn't bother me because he's not slowing down the game.
Right.
And it's better than him just, you know, getting up and watching TV or something.
I posted, just sort of tongue-in-cheek, some goofy player and DM powers, and one of them was EMP Pulse.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know, an at-will for the DM and an encounter for the player that you can hit the button and say, all right, cut the electronic stuff. So that's probably just something you have to feel out
when
the table is progressing.
That's a cool idea. I like it.
I have one player that's in their 20s, and my 4-year-old probably has a better attention span. It's like every time it's that person's turn, it's, huh, what? What are we? Where are we? What are we doing? And I try and give that player things to do, because if I don't, they'll be watching TV or surfing the internet, and I'm not to the point where I'll just be a dick and be like, get rid of that, you know, because it's their phone. I'm not going to tell them what to do with it, but I try and say, you know, could you take some notes, or, you know, just anything to try and get them.
Keep them engaged when it's not their activity time. Yeah.
I had a player just like that, and what I ended up doing was I had him keep track of initiative. And that kind of solved that problem, because he had to be engaged every single round, basically who's coming next.
Delaying and readying and all that.
Condition markers would be the other one to assign somebody to putting condition markers out.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Or if you've got a player with a lot of really bad attention span problems in your encounters, put a lot of terrain features that can be used as immediate interrupts. Like, I don't know, like some abandoned traps or something like that. When you run the minions off, that can then be set off by the players as immediate interrupts. Because as soon as they've got an immediate interrupt power, they're paying attention for a chance to use it.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting toward the end here.
We are, actually. So. We really are. So we've got about 5 minutes left. I'd just like to sort of wrap up the conversation and say thank you, everyone, for participating. I hope that a lot of good ideas came out of this conversation, that you're able to take back to your own games, and feel free to come up and see us afterward. But we'll call it a wrap.
All right. Thank you, everyone.